When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Welcome to another episode of On the Continent, your one-stop shop for everything to do with European football. I'm Dotun Adebayo.
I'm Andy Brassel.
And I'm Miguel Delaney.
On this okie-cokie edition of the pod, will PSG's Collectif Ultras Paris be singing Nous sommes les champions at the Parc de France on Le Weekend, or will the champagne and the champignons be on ice? Also, the best, the worst and the ugliest of Atletico Madrid, just another night in the Champions League, and we are singing the Super League blues. It's dead, but is it buried? That's what it's all about. Andy, first of all, let's get one thing clear. As we speak, it is unclear as to whether Mauricio Pochettino will be the coach of PSG next season or not. He will be this weekend when they aim to get the title or secure the title.
Yeah, let's let him lift the trophy first, I reckon. So it could have been last night, and for a while it looked like it would be. Full midweek round of fixtures in France. Paris Saint-Germain won 3-0 at Angers. And if Marseille had failed to win against Nantes, and they were behind twice at the Velodrome, then it would have been official. As it is, Marseille came from behind twice to win 3-2, and what was a pretty good game. And it means that PSG still need 1 point to make it mathematically certain. And, you know, I'm sure it's lovely they win at home, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there's been a bit of a sea change in how Pochettino has approached things this week. Now, for the first time, he addressed what not getting to the Champions, not getting through in the Champions League meant. Now, before, of course, he was blustering, I guess, understandably, in the aftermath about the apparent foul on Donnarumma by Benzema, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, after that second leg. But it's the first time he talked about what it meant. And he said, well, obviously the season's a bit of a failure if you don't get further in the Champions League than we did, and if you don't get the Champions League. So that was an admission of that. And what was also interesting is that you always find this when someone speaks on a big issue on football, unless they're as explicit and unequivocal as explicit and unequivocal can be, there's several different interpretations of their words. Now, Pochettino said, I still have a contract for next season. Does that mean he's staying at Paris Saint-Germain? No, what it means is if you want to get rid of me, which I know you do, and I want to leave, you're going to have to pay for it still. I'm not gonna quit and leave with nothing.
We're going to obviously discuss bigger things with PSG in a moment. But just as you were talking, that kind of struck me. This feeds into kind of wider discussions we've had about the kind of the broader football world at the moment. But do you remember the big debate about Poch for so long was that, he hasn't won a trophy. He's not a winner. And now he's going to win it. He's going to win a domestic title. But like, it means far less than basically anything he did at Spurs or even Espanyol. It means nothing to no one.
When you consider the gap between them and Marseille, they're in a different league in the French league. But he'll take it though, won't he? He'll take that as proof that he can win a domestic league. But where will he take it to?
And who takes it as proof? I think is the question, given the financial gap between them and the rest. I think that's the big issue, really. I mean, it does feel as empty as titles get. And I don't know, even at the end of that game against Angers, it felt really empty because they overpower a team. They've got loads more money than difficult way trip, et cetera, et cetera, of course. But after they get through this, there's a sense that once they've got the title sealed up, what Pochettino is going to do is he's going to do what he wants to do. He's going to blood some of these young players. And of course, that hasn't been...
To show the club what his actual ideal would have been.
Yeah, this is my strength. Okay. This is what I'm about.
And so for the next few games, the rest of the season.
Yeah, they've got six games left, something like that. And so, towards the end of this game against Angers, he brings on Dino Mbimbe has already played the game in midfield. He brings on another teenager, Edouard Michu. And you think, he's going to give him a couple of games from here. Just before full time, with PSG 3 up, Michu gets sent off. I think he's a little harshly dealt with because he receives a tackle from behind, which makes him go up in the air and stud up someone else. And on VAR advice, he gets sent off. And the look on Pochettino's face, he's got a face like thunder as Michu goes off the pitch. And he's like, God, I'm not even going to be able to play him. Am I? Yeah. And it's just, I think, in microcosm, the gap between what the club wants and what he's great at. And it's just another underlining of it's just not meant to be, really.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, again, I remember from very early on, there was people who know Pochettino, people who are aware of how Paris Saint-Germain works. I mean, the restrained view is almost Pochettino is going to have to compromise a lot of how he works to do this job. And
Everything.
So, I mean, really, all it's served is basically that he gets that league title. That's essentially it. And it doesn't really change much for him. It does feel a little bit like Pochettino. While he was so perfectly the man in the right place at the right time for Spurs, it was really such a victory of time in both where he was in his career, where that Spurs squad was, the state of the Premier League at the time, and the peaks he brought into, like, he's suffered with timing so much since. We're kind of, jobs that might be better for him than Paris Saint-Germain have just become available at the wrong time.
Yes.
I mean, the latest was obviously Manchester United, but it's been similar with Real Madrid, with Juventus, with almost a cast of them across Europe.
Mm. You know, the PSG job should have been made for him, essentially, because he was a PSG legend to a certain extent. However, he should have known from what we've seen of PSG, certainly since the Qatari takeover, he should have known that that wasn't the right place for a manager on his level, an ascending level after Tottenham. He should have known that. He should have waited for this Man United job. And it would have been
his. I just think he's waited a little bit too long.
He had
to take a job.
Yeah, that's true.
Because you know how, that like for the first 6 months after you lose or quit your job, as a top coach, it's almost your legend cachet augments.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what happened to him? He was great. Yeah. He was really great. And your reputation is inflated beyond your actual means. But then it gets to a certain point, you're not quite entering the Kerbishley zone, but you're getting to that point, whereas, why is no one touching him? You know, so it is difficult. And as Miguel was saying, so much of being a successful coach is the right jobs at the right time. And the wrong choices can absolutely knacker you. Now, I don't think this has done it to Pochettino. But when you talk about chronology, Miguel, of course, Erik ten Hag has just got the Manchester United job, which a lot of people feel Pochettino would have been perfect for. It's clear that there are certain Italian coaches, not just one, certain Italian coaches that interest Paris Saint-Germain going forward. Could you see a way still where Pochettino makes his way back to Tottenham?
Yeah, not impossible at all, actually. In fact, we could well see a job swap in the summer. Because I think it's very much 50-50 that Conte stays at Spurs. Even before anything has happened, obviously things are better than they were a few months ago, but there's still a feeling around him that they could be at a better job where they could be winning top trophies. So I do think severance is possible in summer, particularly depending on where they finish in the league and also their transfer business. I think if he gets Spurs into the Champions League, that does change. You know, it'd be at least more difficult to go. But already, I think Spurs are trying to be much more proactive in the window this summer to kind of keep him happier, but that may not be enough if they finish outside the top four. So we could well see a situation, where basically PSG come along for Conte. Although, actually, just as a digression, I mean, given how Conte works, I'm not sure that suits the squad either.
He's totally unsuitable for PSG, PSG are totally unsuitable for him. That doesn't mean it won't happen, of course.
Yeah.
Much like with Pochettino.
But yeah, we could well see Conte going to PSG, and then suddenly the Spurs job is free, and maybe it might work out.
I have to declare my North London interest here, because I was always told when I grew up in Tottenham, never return to the scene of the crime, as it were. And particularly when, I'm not saying anything. Why are you laughing about this?
But no reason.
Particularly when somebody else has been there and, you know, like, checked for the fingerprints, as it were, or rearranged things for you. And I just wonder whether it was an advisable move to go back. Would you not think this time he should wait a moment?
I think
does he not have the moment to wait?
Yeah, I'm not sure he does. Okay. I think the ideal doesn't necessarily exist when you're in this. He's in this kind of weird netherworld, Pochettino, in that he's an enormously highly rated coach, but he's never emphatically proved himself at elite level.
Yeah,
and he's already 50.
I was actually thinking this recently with Pochettino. I mean, and whether there are many historical equivalents. So maybe there are people like Zdenek Zeman, but a coach maybe who almost goes unfulfilled, where he has a great reputation, and yet when you, I suppose as we all do, when you kind of look back in 30 years on Wikipedia and look at his honours roll, you're going, why was he so rated? Can you think of many examples like that?
Was Zeman? You always think of Bielsa, don't you?
Yeah, Bielsa's actually.
But Pochettino's not quite in that spot, because you know Bielsa has never, at club level at least, coached at absolute elite level, has he?
No, exactly.
So,
yeah,
so
yeah.
It's fine for a like Pep Guardiola to sit around and go, oh, well, with my team, he would have won everything. I mean, I think a few of us, you know, that's probably not true.
Yeah, yeah.
And certainly not in a long-term sense. But now,
I was just going to say, with or without Conte, PSG are due a restructuring, are they not?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think anyone with any sort of basic football knowledge would think that really PSG have to have a complete rethink of the entire project and where this is going. Whether they actually do that is,
I think the question is not if there's going to be an attempted restructure, but who leads it? Because I get the sense that from Qatar, the trust is not in Leonardo. We know that Pochettino probably not going to be there next season, almost certainly not going to be there next season. Nasser Al-Khelaifi, the president, does he get to lead it? Because if you think the current project is a failure, it's maybe reached its limit, they're lumbered with big contracts with Neymar and Messi, at least for the medium term. So that affects manoeuvrability, even with the sort of semi-retirement of FFP that's coming up. And I think it's interesting, just as Nasser Al-Khelaifi went over Leonardo's head and said, you know what, as you've not sealed the re-signing of Kylian Mbappe, I'm going to deal with this. Even though it's your job, I'm going to deal with this. Now, he's not got him to sign on dotted line as either. So it's clear that in this restructuring, we know they can offer Mbappe all the money in the world to stay. They're also asking him, how would you reshape the club?
Mm.
How would you do things differently? What sort of future model would you like to see? Now, it's clear they want to lean on their area around them. Like, geographically, they produce as much football talent as pretty much anywhere in the world, probably apart from Sao Paulo. So how can they get that to work effectively? I think in the short term, that is quite a difficult sell, because how would you convince young Parisians that you can come here and play? Everything that they've done over the last 10 years says that no matter how good you are, if you are good enough for the French national team, like Christopher Nkunku, for example, you still can't get in our team. You still can't play meaningful minutes. I think it's funny the fact that, you know, Leipzig won't sell Nkunku unless it's for a mega offer this summer. But PSG have been linked with, you know, buying him back for 70 million euros. I mean, that's the ultimate sort of failure of this sort of model. If a guy that you basically treated like he was a spare part, you end up buying him back for 70 million. You know, maybe they can't do that. I think he'd be a pretty good signing for them still. He'd be a pretty good signing. I mean, this is a guy who's not an out-and-out striker. He scored 30 goals this season and propelled Leipzig into a really good place. But I think that is the thing with Mbappe, for example. Even though he hasn't come through the PSG Academy, because he's from Paris, I think having a hometown hero is really, really important. As well as
hence Pogba potentially going back as well.
Yes, as well as projecting some sort of power in terms of, you know, this is the best striker in the world or the next best footballer in the world, and we have him. The fact that he's a hometown hero is super important.
But just on that as well, I mean, obviously there are so many potential criticisms of what the PSG project is, beyond anything else, the fact that it's a sports washing project for Qatar. But it is also a sadness in the sense that this is a club, like almost a contradiction to my, this is a club that's sitting on top of one of the three most fertile football areas in the world. The other two, I'm constantly told, are South London now and Sao Paulo.
Mm.
And the other one is Paris, the wider, greater Paris area. I mean, if any sort of kind of medium club, in fact, there's so many kind of French clubs that will have the profile, basically, that will be perfect to sit in that area, use the connection of being at their local club, and basically almost build a really proactive, modern, healthy club just through constantly bringing the youth through. But obviously PSG just have no interest in that. And even PSG themselves could be some way more palatable if they changed tack. I mean, if they did what another sports washing project in Manchester City did, put in the correct infrastructure and then used it to bring through these players constantly. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem like there's any sort of football mindset at the club to go down that route. Well,
if they pivot in that direction, it's such a 180 from what they said like 2 years ago when they binned Diaby and when they binned Nkunku.
Yeah, and as you were saying earlier, Andy, you know, like if you're a young player at that club, like they can say whatever they want to you, but because of the politics of the club, no matter what they promise you, there's always a danger that someone higher up will just go and they'll be, nah, sorry, we promise you football, but we're going to sign this 32-year-old instead. He's got 3 million Instagram followers and and he's won some trophies, so...
It's great to have you back, Miguel, following all your dispatches from Qatar ahead of the World Cup. But you will have witnessed this week perhaps the best, the worst, and definitely the ugliest of one of the great teams of recent times in the Champions League, relatively lowly Atletico Madrid, when you compare them to Real Madrid as well. They took on Manchester City, and I've read your piece on this. They knew that they couldn't play and beat Manchester City at their game, so they introduced another game that Manchester City should have been expecting, at least Pep Guardiola should have been expecting.
Well, you say that, before you get to that, two goalless draws a week apart, one against Manchester City, one against Granada.
They suck everyone to that level. No, nil all.
It's remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah. On that though, see, I actually think that... they could beat Manchester City. This is my problem. My main issue actually isn't the last 15 minutes, which everyone else found ugly. I thought that was brilliantly entertaining. That's kind of what Atletico was about. And also, that chaos kind of served them to a degree because it sufficiently disrupted City. But the issue was more how that reflected what they could have done had they been a bit more aggressive during the game. And this is when we get into kind of bigger discussions about Simeone. And also... where he is as a manager now and where football is going. Because I mean, ultimately, Atletico Madrid, right, he's of course transformed the entire identity of the club. But that also means they're no longer really the upstarts in the same way. Fair enough, they're not as wealthy as Barcelona and Real Madrid, but they're wealthier than, much wealthier than most of Spain. And yet they still generally attempt, okay, with some evolution this season, but they still generally attempt the same approach, which is this kind of... Which is still reactive football. It's still, I would at this point say, the misuse of attacking talent. And it's increasingly difficult not to think. It's basically Jose Mourinho 3.0 in a football world that is now moving in a completely other direction.
But the evolution that you're talking about, the gentle evolution.
Yeah.
I know Atletico and gentle don't really go together. The evolutions of players. It's not him, is it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And in fact, when I was in Madrid last week, I was having a conversation with someone about exactly this. They're pointing to kind of growing tensions in Atletico Madrid in this way. Whereas, first of all, there has been some unrest between Simeone and the hierarchy because he is very, very difficult to buy players for. Because like Mourinho before him, he has specific types, most of all, a big number nine. But the way football goes now, it's not really producing big number nines anymore. Even those players who physically could be big number nines, they play in a different way, like Erling Haaland.
Funnily enough, his eldest son would be a really good centre forward for him, wouldn't he?
Yeah, yeah. But so there is already frustration there, and that means that kind of Simeone himself, as you say, he has to adapt to players that he doesn't necessarily. Idealise. I mean, everyone knows the issues between him and João Felix.
Well, I was coming to that because we've got a message here on Instagram from Nathan who says, do you both think that João Felix will stay at Atletico or will Simeone's style of play ruin things? And we know where that's going. Why on earth did he buy a player like as talented, young player, as talented as João Felix, if actually what he would rather him do is fight a rear guard action for the team.
I would imagine that wasn't really to do with Simeone, as usually influential as he is in that club, and again, this is one of the points of tension that I was spoken about, that basically constantly, especially underneath in the kind of youth infrastructure. Atletico are trying to do things in a very modern way. And then you get to the first team and it's still kind of this, you know, world unto itself, really.
I mean, it's funny what you were saying about the possibility of him and his way of doing things and holding them back, certainly in terms of recruitment. I think what's interesting about Atletico, and you see it this season with Antoine Griezmann, buying players back. Can we think of any other elite team who's made such a line in buying players back?
And what summed that up was basically his break in the first leg against City. I couldn't help thinking, I'm sure you're the same, he was in exactly the same situation against a Pep Guardiola team 6 years beforehand, and he raced through and scored. And that suited Simeone's football because of the sheer speed of it. Mm. 6 years on, and Griezmann literally didn't have the pace to get away.
But he's been kind of coached out of that as well.
Yeah, I mean,
because there's that famous scene in one of the home games just before the end of one of his last games of the first spell at Atletico, where they're winning 1-0 against an inferior opponent. And as you pointed out in your piece, Miguel, the issue is not that they play apparently reductive football against Manchester City. I think if you limit Manchester City to one goal over two games, that's pretty good. It's the fact they do the same thing against Granada, who are bottom of the table, or near the bottom of the table, come into the Wanda Metropolitano and Atleti get, a handful of shots off?
I know.
And you know, the keeper's not really, the Granada goalkeeper's not really worked either. I think that's the thing. But there's that, going back to the Griezmann thing. So they're beating an inferior team, I don't know, Osasuna or someone like that, 1-0. And Griezmann makes this break towards the halfway line. And then he's got loads of space to run into and he stops. And he holds the ball up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And wins a throw-in. And the crowd give him shit and say, what are you doing? Yeah. And he turns around, Mourinho style, puts his finger to his lips. And he's like the personification of Simeone on the pitch.
Yeah, and actually, first of all, I'm going to say, Osasuna or something like that. Disrespect.
The thing is, I thought, think of a mid-table team. And then I just looked across and I saw you.
But honestly, when I was at that... at that game against City, and I've been to a few big Atletico games now, both at the Calderon and now in the Metropolitano era, and I did kind of think to myself, actually, it's a famous Eamon Dunphy line about Jack Charlton's Ireland in 1990. But you know, you're in a great European city, a great European football city, one of the biggest names in world football. That, to be fair, he has played his part, and of course, restoring. And you go to this new great arena. You sit there, and I'm like, it's a stadium that will put so many to shame. And I think crucially as well, it feels like a football stadium in a way, actually, many modern stadiums don't. It's got that atmosphere. Then you sit down or stand up and you watch that. Or you go to a great festival and you produce that. And yet, then at the end of the game, they've been knocked out, having barely had a shot in a game that was there for the taking. And the fans are lapping it up.
It's like the cult of Mourinho at Roma.
It's gaslighting.
Simeone is the problem, as I'm presuming you're both saying, how on earth can he be the best paid coach in the world?
Because he has turned them from also-rans in a pile of debt to Champions League perennials. And he has won a load of stuff. It is the most successful decade in Atletico's history. Now, whether the game has moved on from him since the start of his spell there, and I think that's the thing, that people never really make the difference between his 2014 and 2016 Champions League finalists and the current team, and this team that remarkably won La Liga last season. But there is a huge difference in terms of expectation, in terms of wage bill. They can't afford to miss the Champions League. And they haven't been able to afford to miss the Champions League for quite a long time, actually. They've been scarily dependent on it. But in terms of liability, not least his wages, we might add, as you pointed out there, there's a lot riding on it. What happens if they miss the top four this season? And results like that against Granada, when they go out against one of the worst teams in the league, and yeah, Aitor Karanka has gone there and played very bravely in his first game as coach, and well done to him, etc., etc. Come on. Yeah. They should be pummeling Granada with the players they've got. And I understand they've got Lamar and Joao Felix out. They've got so many other alternatives and they barely lay a glove on them.
Actually,
and if they miss the top four, where does that leave them? And where does that leave him?
If they miss top four, actually, does that suddenly make Joao Felix, because they need money, does it put him suddenly under Haaland-Mbappe bracket? Okay, he doesn't quite have the reputation of those two, but I think he should certainly have the reputation of Haaland, I have to say. Does it suddenly make him a, hey, this top forward, but who's the future of your club potentially? Is he suddenly available?
Joao Felix, I think, is really interesting because I think people look at him and think he's not an Atletico player.
Yeah, yeah.
He is. He really is. He's gutsy. He doesn't back down. Yeah. He can score those scruffy striker goals, which they've only belatedly seemed to realise. And yet he's got the talent to lead them forward.
Yeah, yeah.
They have to give him the keys to the team. Simeone has to give him the keys to the team. Interestingly, whatever happens to Cholo Simeone this summer, and I wouldn't completely rule out an exit, debut last night for Giuliano Simeone, his 19-year-old son. So you've got the next generation
coming
of Cholismo there, whatever happens.
It goes back, though, to what you were saying in your article and you said a bit earlier on, that they can win these games should they choose to. Will they?
Well, there always comes a point in, I think, managers' careers in that way where, and I should have pointed out for all my kind of mocking tone about how Atletico fans lap it up, as you say, ultimately, Simeone is the most important figure in the history of the club. That shouldn't be overlooked. But because of that, and because of past work gets you to a certain point, and this pretty much happened with every single great manager you can think of, bar Ferguson, and maybe kind of one or two other exceptions, rather than the early point of their career where they're still some way, they have an idea, but they're still some way fluid about it, and they basically do what it takes to get them there, they become wedded to a style, because it becomes hard fixed and it goes in the other direction, and it means they can't evolve in the way that's necessary. And again, it's exactly what kind of Andy's been pointing to. Like, it's kind of a gentle evolution or almost a superficial evolution.
Basically, ultimately, every football coach is Mick Jagger, and they just end up playing the hits forever until it's the end.
But there's an extra element of a football coach, is because then, and this happens with, this happened with Mourinho, happened with Rafa Benitez, happened with Wenger, because obviously Mick Jagger doesn't have the issue of results. But it becomes about proving that their method still works. It's not the game that's changed. All right.
Yeah, you know? I'm a force of nature.
I'm above this. And then it's almost they get kind of more bloody-minded about it, which becomes actually self-defeating.
But Simeone is an extreme example of that, isn't he, as well? Because when you see the amazing thing, like two images for me this season underline Simeone. Firstly, when they lose away at Camp Nou, going back a couple of months, and Daniel Vaz comes on, makes his terrible debut as a substitute, and gets injured as well. And Simeone's trying to pick him off the floor, and he's like, actually, I'm kind of seriously injured here. And he ends up being out for 6 weeks. And Simeone just like grabs him by the back of his armpits and pulls him up and tells him to, look, get on with it. We can't do this with 10 men. Come on. And the other thing is the game you were at last week, Miguel, where he's just leading the crowd. Conducting the orchestra. It's amazing.
The sarcastic applause. Did you watch the documentary on him, actually, the Amazon one?
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, I must say, especially given Amazon's All or Nothing series have been so bad, I was actually surprised at how good this was.
Well, he's very open, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. And also the voices they get into are amazing. Like, basically anyone you can think of who is willing to talk about him. And they talk so honestly. But one of the standout moments, though, was actually, it was again during that, and exact sort of thing you're talking about, during that that Bayern Munich Atletico match in 2016, where he kind of like almost physically assaults his staff member, I can't remember his name, that has to.
The team delegate who does the subs.
Yeah, exactly. And then even the way the guy can makes allowances for him, it's just El Cholo in the middle of these events.
That's it. He is that unstoppable force. It's like when him and his kids, who are the three boys are all footballers, aren't they? Where they're sat around the table having a mate and talking really honestly in his home, and Gio goes to him, "See that, Dad? got more kids than you've got friends.
Well, actually, just as a briefest digression, do you think Atletico and Simeone's managerial career, is this unfair to him as a player maybe, but because of his mentality on football, it actually prevented him being the player he could have been as well? I know that's quite a mad thing to say for someone that played at Inter.
And won a lot of stuff.
And won a lot of stuff, yeah. But there was almost that sense that he could have been Redondo, actually, but instead was just...
I don't think he wanted to be.
You know what I mean? But that's what I mean, though. But he could have been, but he had no... Like he could have been a kind of much more refined...
Could have been a contender, Charlie.
You get that sense, don't you? You know, when him and Juan Sebastian Verón talk about the fact that they're brothers, but definitely not friends. Because they've just got such opposite views of things.
Yeah.
And you know, that when we think of like, we characterise Argentinian footballers in a certain way, like they couldn't really be any more different, could they?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Andy, I see that you've been talking about the Super League on Football Ramble Presents this week.
Yeah, that's right. We've got this three-part series, Back from the Brink, where we commemorate a year from the Super League announcement. I know, I can't believe it's a year. It seems millions of years ago. Everything that went on, we talked to journalists who broke the story, supporters who protested, people from all over Europe, and how they feel about it now.
So, Miguel, is the Super League dead and buried or not?
It actually depends on just two ways to look at it. First of all, there's the Super League project, the European Super League project itself, which has been dependent on this case going to the European Court of Justice, which is ultimately about, it's not really about a Super League. It's basically about the top European clubs trying to create their own Premier League, which is basically a federation to replace UEFA, where they're the main shareholders. Because what that case is about is whether UEFA in Europe or beyond, or any federation, has the sole right to set up sporting competition.
It's about who runs football.
Yeah, that's really exactly it. That's
because the Premier League is groundbreaking in the sense that it's for the clubs by the clubs, if you like.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. Where the clubs are the shareholders in that way. And that's obviously what a lot of European clubs want from the Champions League. Now, it had been put to me that had, up until this week, the line I'd heard was there was a 50-50 chance of victory for either side on a purely legal basis. But they did think the political weight behind protecting the kind of the wider health of the game would swing it for UEFA if it ever got to court. You would think, though, there has been a development as we speak today and Thursday afternoon that might just edge it further, which is basically now the Madrid court has lifted the injunction imposed on UEFA, meaning UEFA, if it wants now, can punish Madrid, Barcelona and Juve for attempting to, in Sheffrin's words, destroy histories. But that's only the Super League project as we came to know it a year ago. Because on the other side, there's actually the reality of football right now, and whether, after all that, UEFA are actually just institutionalizing a Super League. Because it's very difficult not to think that's exactly what's happening.
With the 2024 format.
Yeah.
I mean, it's different though, isn't it? Because what you're saying is it's not about the competition. Mm. It's about who's running it, really. And it's about the right to run it.
Yeah.
So in that sense, however UEFA reformat it, it's not really going to make a difference, is it, to Real Madrid and Barcelona?
But the issue is more the net effect, I'd say, because for all that the Super League had been seen as a threat to the domestic competitions, its main challenge was that it was basically going to supplant the Champions League. That was going to happen. But what's going to happen now instead, domestically, with these post-2024 reforms? So, I mean, in their ideal world, the big clubs, they would have continued with the domestic leagues. Mm. That would have been husks. They dominate even more.
Yeah.
And play their Super League in midweek or whenever what was eventually going to happen with it. Whereas now the alternative future, or now what feels a likely future, is that basically we have the domestic leagues, but we also have a Champions League that even more than before is loaded towards the big clubs. Especially, I mean, there's been this constant to back and forth about, say, these, you know, the historic legacy places, so to speak, which are essentially based on club coefficient performance. Now, some within the European leagues, within kind of within UEFA, people outside the big clubs, basically, they still have hope they'll be pushed back in that. The 10th of May is when all this will be decided. But it hasn't been taken off the table yet. If UEFA implement that, it just basically, it copper fastens places for the big clubs, really. It almost makes it certain that they get those places. And the other side of this is, and this is something that's almost gone under the radar, but kind of basically sums up, you know, the entire problem, a core issue of the Super League. If you think, say, I think I might have brought this up in the show before, but if, say, let's say at the end of last season, the Premier League, because of the way UEFA prize money works, and because so much it's based on exactly what we're talking about, on historic performance, on coefficients by each club, on how you've done in the last 5 years, and that cumulative effect. Had it been Leicester City that qualified for the Champions League on the last day of the 2021 season, they would have got, they would have been, had guaranteed prize money, I think, of just under 2 million. Because it was Chelsea, and because they've been in the Champions League so often over the last few years where Leicester haven't, it was guaranteed 30 million. Now, in that kind of world, how is the disparity in football ever going to be tackled? How are we not in a situation where just the gaps widen and widen and widen? And then because of potential regulations like historic places, the Champions League just becomes a Super League by another form. And yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not about who runs the game is still different. But does that matter so much when UEFA basically, they're not allowed to look after the wider health of the game? Because, I mean, we've discussed this in the show before. For me, the biggest crisis in football now is it's the competitive balance of the sport. And how, I mean, we have Bayern Munich winning 10 titles in a row. PSG could, like, literally, we've just been talking about how Pochettino is going to win a title at Paris Saint-Germain, and it means nothing because everyone expects him to.
Well, the question is really whether the tinkering amounts to anything, which is the point of Jack's tweet here, where he says, do you think the proposed changes to the Champions League will last or be a flash in the pan format like the famous, and who remembers this, two-group stage version of the competition?
The thing is, I think it stays, at least medium term, because it's the biggest change to the format. The two-group stage is one comparison. When you think of the original format of the Champions League in 1992, which was a lot more leaguey than the current cup form, once you've got back to that, I don't see a situation when, and you see it now, I think post-pandemic, in that every common sense rule around football says play less.
Yeah.
Allow less space in the calendar. Don't let us get into the situation we got in March 2020. But you know what? The game solution to that at all levels, domestically and continentally, has been, you know what? We can't turn the money tap off.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's ram the same amount of football into a shorter amount of time. So I would say to Jack, if you think that we're going to get to a point where the clubs and the governing body think, you know what? It's just a bit boring. Let's cut the amount of games. It's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. Yeah. Once they've got those extra games, they're not going to let them go.
The one thing I would say, though, it's maybe this exact format, I'd say, but they will just, as Andy says, it'll be this in a different form, because I think it does feel like there's a little bit of, it almost feels like it's for the sake of it, an era of experimentation. And I was actually just thinking this in relation to, say, what's going to happen with the 48-team World Cup. That the football staple, the four-team group, which is basically the kind of foundation of any, what we've all grown up with, the foundation of all these knockout tournaments, or international knockout tournaments, that's going to become a thing of the past, bar potentially the Euros. Because it's going to be gone from the Champions League, gone from the World Cup.
Does any of the tinkering address the issue that you mentioned, which is the disparity, disparity? None of them
do. It makes it worse, because it's guaranteeing, I mean, what this comes from is, it's guaranteeing the big clubs more big games, but they're big games. This is what's becoming a problem in football. It's more games, but more games with less meaning.
Yeah, that's it. There'll be so many more dead rubbers in this.
Yeah, yeah.
And people have complained about that in a six game group stage.
Yeah,
what's it going to be like in a ten game group stage?
And what this comes from is basically because people see the group stage and rightly think, well, this is mostly boring. Champions League doesn't start until February. But the problem with that isn't the format, the structure. The problem with that is what we've been talking about, financial disparity. That there's basically about 10 to 14 clubs that are too financially powerful for the rest. So they're basically, they can lose two group games and still they're guaranteed to win the other four and go through.
But actually the Premier League has changed that, hasn't it? And that has been part of the push behind the Super League. And I think that's the reason why, you know, I know we've all really enjoyed the knockout stages of the Europa League and the Conference League. But I think when you look at the group stage of the Europa League, and I know like people get very enthusiastic about the Europa League, and great, the back end of it is great. The group stage of the Europa League is much worse than the group stage of the Champions League, and it's not because it's got worse teams in it. It's because there's a bigger gap between the good teams and the not good teams. When you've got, say, take Lyon, for example, who've had a poor season, knocked out in the quarterfinals on the back of quite a bad performance against West Ham, et cetera, been through that elsewhere. The fact is that a team of their size, they've been in like two European semi-finals in the past 5 years. They've got a stadium that holds 60,000 people, loads of valuable players. Of course they're going to knock off six wins in a row. It doesn't mean they're good. It means there's a huge gap between the teams who've got it and teams who haven't. And I think you're going to see this even more in the Europa League, Europa Conference League, which has kind of become already. It's like a European League Cup, isn't it?
Yeah,
That everyone goes, well, what even is this competition in the early stages? And then when you get to the back end, you've got Leicester, PSV, Roma. Look at the wage bills. Barcelona.
Yeah, yeah. I know people.
So, not Barcelona, sorry. Europa League.
Even speaking as we do here in England, I know there's been some sentiment. Oh, it's great that Leicester are able to kind of get so far in a European competition. But they're still from one of the top five leagues. What? So, like, three of the clubs left in the Europa Conference are from the top five leagues. I think that's a massive shame. Can you imagine the buzz around? Like, for me, what the spirit of the Europa Conference should be is basically given the bottom 25 or 30 federations a chance to taste what a bit of international glory is about.
Yeah, you're thinking a Bodø/Glimt Feyenoord final, aren't you, or something like that.
The buzz.
That would be nice. Just very quickly, because I know it's an interesting conversation. Let's pick up on it again another time because it won't have gone away. But Tim has got a question on Instagram. With the seasons coming to a close, which teams were your biggest surprises or disappointments? Very quickly.
Bodø/Glimt getting all the way to the quarterfinals of the conference league.
Yeah, that's what it was about.
That Roma took to the fourth attempt to beat them in their games. I think that was absolutely amazing. In terms of league performances, Strasbourg, who, as we spoke, beat Rennes last night. Strasbourg could get in the Champions League next season, which it would be a phenomenal achievement. Now we're talking about the gap widening between the haves and the have-nots. I think particularly in that context, Strasbourg qualifying for the Champions League would be amazing because they would be like Marseille are almost there behind PSG. That would be Strasbourg pipping Rennes. And I know people are saying, oh, it'd be nice to see Rennes in the Champions League. They spent a shitload last summer.
Well, I'm going to offer a contradictory one as well. I mean, an obvious answer to what we're talking about is Villarreal getting to the Champions League semi-final. But, and while it's great that in this context we're talking about that a club like Villarreal can do that still, part of me can't help think, if we're going to have an upstart, does it have to with this sort of football? I mean, and don't get me wrong, Emery, it's to his credit, he's shown his mettle, but... when you think of upstarts, it's better when it's a team doing something different or playing a football that kind of makes Europe take note. Klopp's Dortmund, Ten Hag's Ajax, Kiev 99, and they're exciting, and you can kind of like there's a real momentum behind them. Whereas it does feel very kind of it's hardline pragmatic.
You know what it is? It's the second series of Auf Wiedersehen, Pep. We admire and respect the experience.
Yeah.
But it's not that thrilling.
Yeah, my old mate Tim Spall was in the first series. Phew. Now, we've answered a lot of your questions on today's show, so we are going to go straight to a Games of the Week now. But do remember you can contact us anytime during the course of the week at Football Ramble, at Dawson Adebayo, at Andy Brassel, and at Miguel Delaney. And you've got a cracking Game of the Week. Well, you had no choice but to go for the biggie.
Absolutely, the Spanish Cup final, or Copa del Rey final. And I think it's all the better because usually we have these events and it feels as though it's invariably, okay, there's one upstart and then you have one of the big boys and like they expect, oh, crap, like this will, like they're going to win 2-0 and that's that. It just takes away from the occasion. Whereas this is Betis against Valencia. Okay, they're not exactly on long-term droughts. Betis more so. Their last major trophy was 2005. Valencia won this competition 3 years ago. But again, the rarity value for any clubs outside the elite in terms of winning the silverware now just adds an extra element to it and makes it all the more precious today. So even though it's kind of an obvious choice in terms of silverware is on the line, it's the nature of the game itself, I think, amplifies that as an event.
And Andy?
I was tempted to go for Inter versus Roma on Saturday tea time. I think that'll be pretty good, even if you will miss the first quarter of an hour of it, because Inter have got the groove back. I think they're favourites for Serie A now, and Roma have turned into, I think, what Mourinho wants them to turn into. There's still an outside chance of them getting top four if Juventus drop a few more points. They're 5 points behind Juventus, which should be enough to hold Roma off, but we don't know. Roma have become good at grinding out the results. But I think I want to have a word for Sunday afternoon, 4 o'clock, Women's Champions League semi-final, first leg between Lyon and Paris Saint-Germain. It is absolutely huge. Barcelona still the favourites for this year's competition. They're playing Wolfsburg in the other semi-final. But this is a huge domestic rivalry between Lyon and PSG. And we've talked before, early, right at the top of the show, about the Qatari money. They won the domestic title last season. It took them a really long time to get there. They've had their hearts broken by Lyon in the Champions League beforehand on a number of occasions, although they have knocked them out as well. So for PSG, with the domestic title almost gone, they've almost lost that. This is huge for PSG, and it's huge for Lyon to try and get their trophy back.
And pain au chocolat all round?
Yeah, something like that. I do think it's the sort of weather where you're going to barbecue. Let's get some steak on, but don't leave it on the barbie too long. Stick it on, flip it, it's done.
Oh, they like their red meat, don't they? You like the, yeah, they do.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, still twitching, really. Yeah. Yeah.
And Spanish omelette for the cup?
Much more clichéd, but it's clichéd for a reason. I'll go for some Valencian paella.
Yeah, that's
because
the one.
That's the best place in the world to do it. I'll be there next week for the Champions League semi-final on the way
back
to Villarreal, and I'm looking forward to it.
Bring some back.
He's being prosecuted for two things at once as well at the moment.
Welcome to another edition of On the Continent.
Sorry, that was...
No, that's good.
He's being prosecuted for two things at once at the moment. Welcome to On the Continent. Sorry.
Football Ramble Presents is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.